you know, I think I was born to do this. It's in my blood. I love the blood, sweat and tears. I love food. I love how it connects everyone. I love how food just, you know, equalizes everyone as just human beings.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. While growing up, most of us dream of all sorts of careers that we might have, sometimes fantastical, sometimes absurd, and mostly unexpected. When it comes to the crunch, what triggers someone to carve out a career in food? Nabila Kadri is the kitchen manager of Supernorma in Melbourne. Nabila, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Anthony, how are you?
I'm great. It's good to get you on the show. You're involved in one of the busiest restaurants in Melbourne. What's it like?
Thank you. It's amazing. It's one of the most surreal experiences. I mean, I've had some pinnacle and high moments in my career, but Supernorma and working for Andrew is definitely one of the highest points of my career. The highlights.
You have had an incredible career, which we'll get into shortly, but tell us a little bit about the scale of Supernorma. Like, how many staff are you sort of dealing with and how many sort of guests a week?
At the moment in the kitchen, we've got about 30 staff members. Some are full-time, some are casual, some are apprentices. So yes, it's a busy kitchen. There's a lot to deal with, but we've got a fantastic management team that supports each other, and we do what is possible. And in terms of numbers, we do about 3,000 covers a week.
Wow.
Give or take. Yes.
That is a busy kitchen. Tell us a little bit about your role. Often we speak to a head chef or an executive chef or kitchen manager of such a big sort of busy kitchen like that. What does your role encompass?
So kitchen manager is a new role for me as well. I took on this role primarily because I've just had baby number two. So I've got two kids that are at home. And that just allowed me to still be in my whites in the kitchen and still be at the front line, if I may say, and use my management experience and my chefing experience at its most while I take a little, it's not so much a step back, but more so explore different arenas of the kitchen and the industry. I get to work alongside the head chef, the executive chef, which is Ben Pollard, Andrew, and I get to help them run the kitchen, you know, structurally, recruitment, service, training, financial part of things. So it's like a shadowing head chef, I guess.
Yeah. It sounds like an incredibly intricate role. What's some of the challenges that you face in this sort of new role that you've got?
I don't know if there's been a lot of challenges, but there's definitely been a lot of highlights, such as being the head chef or, you know, being in the sort of spotlight. You don't get to see a lot of peripherals because you're so zoned into the food, the staff. You don't really, I mean, you know, as Chris Handel says, you have to be a unicorn to be across numbers and the daily sort of ins and outs of what a kitchen has to offer. So I think separating the two roles and allowing me to take more of the admin role, the budgeting role, the training and role has just allowed the head chef to be more creative in his space. Or her, for that matter, but at the moment it's Raf. So, yeah, and I think it's been interesting for me because as a head chef, I took a step back and I see so much more. There's so much potential, especially with the industry going. You know, see, I was at the butt end of old school hospitality. So the fact that we are changing this trend as well, it's been a great platform for me to be a part of this change and implement it. Whether it comes to training, work-life balance, the language we use around it, the importance of mental health, the importance of mentoring, all of that. So I think I've been blessed to be a part of this change without being in the thick of it. And so when I am ready to take that next step, it will be, it's opened up my vision to so much more. And of course, with the help of Andrew and his vision, it just makes it even more creme de la creme. Because he's a visionary, so it's beautiful.
Well, I want to delve into sort of what you're doing there and what you have planned for the future as well. But take us back to when you were young. Whereabouts did you grow up and what sort of role did food play?
So I grew up primarily in Oman, UAE and India. My background is Islamic Indian. So, you know, it's a given that I come from food. Food was the celebration for everything. Ramadan, Eid, weddings, birthday parties. It was either food, jewelry, or lots of perfume. I mean, these were the three things we celebrated the most with. So, so food was always a big part of it. And my mom comes from a Yemeni background, which she then was raised in India. So her recipes were always her pride and joy, and her being the best cook out of the two families. I sort of got trained by my mother a lot because she never gave away any recipes unless it was her daughter. So that's where I sort of started my training under my mother's wing. She's a very disciplined worker. I don't think I touched a dish till I was like 16 or 17. All I did was peeling, cutting, chopping, cleaning. And I remember telling mom, please, can I just at least stir the pot? And she goes, no, you ruined it. So, you know, she's a very, so going into hospitality at a young age and coming, especially because it was male dominated, and it was not a big deal for me when I was yelled at, or there was no please and thank yous. They were just like, no. You know, so I never found that offensive. I guess it worked for me because my mom was so disciplined when I was a teenager. So it sort of shaped me into that person. And of course, my dad, for many, many decades now, I think 3 or 4 decades, he's been in the marketing, the sales part of hospitality in the Middle East and in Singapore. And so the Maldives and that region. Going with him, traveling with him, because he's been in that sector, you know, drop-offs as a supplier, chocolate, cream, all of that, and looking at the big hotels and the tall hats was fascinating for me as a child. So I always knew I wanted to get into that somehow, subconsciously. And when it came to the decision-making of what I'm going to do next, hospitality was the second thing I wanted to do. I mean, first I wanted to be a pilot, but the financial and the, I guess, academic part didn't really align with my vision. So I went for hospitality. Yeah. Not encouraged by the extended family, of course, coming from a Muslim background, but my mom and dad were very encouraging about it. They were like, what? Why would you cook? You live in Dubai. Just get married. You'll have you'll have all the time to cook for your family. So that was quite interesting.
Tell us about your first sort of steps, you know, being a chef. Where did you sort of cut your teeth, and do you have any stories of what that was like?
Yeah. So I started my apprenticeship in 2004 in Melbourne. So when I came as an international student, first MasterChef had not come out. It was late in 2008 or 9. So it definitely wasn't a glamorous job. It was still where dropout kids went. And then to add to the equation, as an international student, most people did it for getting their permanent residency or trying to stay in the country, which was heartbreaking for me because that was never the intention for me. It was all about learning how to be a chef and being the best at my trade and, you know, grinding it out. So that was something that really motivated me to get my teeth into it, get into it. And I had multiple jobs while I was doing my apprenticeship. I think the first thing I did was get a job at a grocery store in Heidelberg, which was called Leo Supermarket, because I wanted to understand the produce. I didn't come from a wine or a alcoholic background, so going and working at the bottle shop over there or the wine shop over there, that was interesting. That really got me, it introduced me to the culture, the food, the lingo, if I may say, the language around it. So that was something that I intentionally did just because I wanted to stand out of the crowd. You know, I knew that I had so many places to go to. So Melbourne was something I chose.
What were some of the important venues and people that you worked
I started working at a cafe first in South Yarra. At the time, cafes were the place to be. And cafes really, it was called Gaia in South Yarra. It was one of the best in town. And it allowed me to, again, just be micro into everything, from the kitchen to ordering to front of house. Our clientele at the time was, you know, the highest profile in town. So their needs, how service is done. So it really opened up my vision to hospitality. I then got approached by Diane Polswank, who was there. They just took over Lynch's on Domain Road at the time. It doesn't exist anymore, which then got turned into Entrecourt. But it was an old school kitchen and I was excited. I was super excited. I was like, ooh, my first real job. Into the industry, into the restaurant industry. They were wearing tall hats and I was like, oh, this is like childhood. This is exactly where I want to be. However, it was an old school kitchen. So I felt like I had to go into something more, a trendier place, a newer place, which would allow me to express myself better. And so then I started working for Chef T. Gezard and Chris Donnellan at Ginger Boy, which was, again, a real trendsetter at the time. You know, production lines weren't a thing. So I guess that's where I got my foundation. Everything was done from scratch, the discipline it required, everything, you know. So that's where I shaped my restaurant career for discipline, recipes, timings, all of that. So I was really blessed to work under them at the time.
T. Gezard made an incredible impact on Melbourne over many decades. Take us into the kitchen of Ginger Boy. Were you dealing with ingredients that you hadn't used before? And what was Teague actually like?
Teague was hard. He was hard. He wanted an answer for everything. Even the papaya salad, I remember, because that's where I sort of dived into the Asian. Melbourne at the time and even now has a heavy influence of Thai, Southeast Asian, Chinese, Vietnamese cooking. And so that was interesting for me. Fish sauce, I'd never used fish sauce before. Palm sugar, actually, we use all over India as well, but not palm sugar. It's called jaggery. So that was something that I was familiar with. The vegetables, however, I was familiar with because, again, Southeast Asia, we have similar profiles. So it did fit into my profile in terms of flavors. It's just there was a lot more umami in it with, you know, soy sauce and fish sauce and all that. And he was very disciplined with how we seasoned our papaya salad, how we seasoned our duck curry. All the paste were made from scratch. Our jungle curries were made from scratch. So I pretty much memorized all the recipes. And I think even now, naturally, I just remember them because he was so disciplined and he knew, even Chris Donnellan, he was Chef of the Year at the time. They were just incredibly creative chefs with a great palate, but also the need to have a brigade that was equally talented. So I rubbed shoulders with some fantastic boys in there that were just driven, disciplined. But then we did have our hospitality moments where we had too many late nights and maybe going straight from the bar to the restaurant, so into the kitchen. Which was also what introduced me to the industry, to be quite honest. It was, you know, it was the butt end of the rockstar era. So I was very glad that I got to be a part of that too. Today, you know, when a chef sell me after service, I'm going to go to the gym. I'm like, what? So, but it is a good change. It is a good change. It's a healthy change and much required, I think.
You spent quite a bit of time with the Lucas Group at various restaurants. Tell us about that period of time and, you know, what you got out of that experience.
I did. Like I said, you know, Ginger Boy was, I think we did 150 covers, 200 covers max. But it was everything was homemade. And so I think the next challenge for me, because I was CDP when I started and then I transferred into sous chef when Cam Whiteoak from Attica started with us, and I got to learn some fan service and all of that. But I think I was ready to go into more of a volume restaurant, something that challenged me more. And I think that's been my biggest strength, is the hunger for more, understanding more, and not being in my comfort zone. And going into Chin Chin and working for Ben Cooper at the time, Chris knew him very well. Teague also knew him, so they referred me to Ben, and they said, why don't you have an interview with him? And when I walked into Chin Chin again, you know, at the time it was one of the hottest restaurants in town, and I saw the volumes they were doing, and I was like, this is incredible, but I don't know if I can do this. This is like 500 covers a day. It's nonstop. It's go time. I mean, who eats musban curry at 11 o'clock in the morning? But apparently they did. And I was like, oh my God, this is crazy. But I loved it. I walked into it with a positive attitude. At the time, Dan Briggs, who's now the executive chef, was the head chef. He was very supportive of me. Everyone was, actually. And I didn't really tell people where I came from. Whenever somebody asked me in the kitchen, so where have you worked before? I said, oh, here and there. You know, I just never, I didn't want a stigma attached to me or a background attached to me. Oh, she comes from Ginger Boy and, you know, it's a fine dining restaurant. And I just wanted to fit in, I guess, be a part of the team. And that was where it all started. And I was, I guess I did okay. And I got my next project, which was Kong, which was the Korean brand that we opened. Again, I got to be a part of the whole branding process from bottom up. That was incredible. Then I came across Jonathan Alliston at Baby, where Chris Lucas also supported me, and my hunger for more, my discipline. I guess my biggest attribute is just discipline and loyalty. I really appreciate what I've been given, and that's where I learned my numbers and business and how to turn a business into a profitable business. After Baby, I moved to France for a few years. When I came back, Kisume was on the cards, and I started as sous chef at Kisume, and then within 6 months into head chef with Chef Moon and Joshua Bedell, which was, again, an incredible journey, one that I did not know I was capable of.
Well, tell us about, because you, while you're in the Lucas Group, you became head chef, and you're also executive chef with Hawker Hall. How did those roles change you and your perception of a role as a chef leading the team like that?
I think even now, female chefs are a minority in an industry this big. It had its challenges. Not saying that every female chef has this, but we are expressive. We are, we do have more, I think I just wanted to hold the flag for many. So many of the other generations that come along, and many of my other colleagues. I think in the beginning, I had to walk on eggshells and just be a little bit more diligent with what I do, because not everybody is used to being a woman in an authoritative position. So that was quite, there were days where I questioned if I was good enough, I guess. And Chef Jonathan and people like Chef Joshua Bedell, Chris Lucas, they really supported me and navigated the way I thought about things, a broader vision, not to narrow my vision down to sections or to people. I have always been the kind of person that appreciates the human race for what it is. So I think that really helped. I'm a good listener. I like different people. So I think that really helped me to sort of help my colleagues and my juniors to find their path, and my belief in my team. You are really nothing without the team that you are with. I'm very grateful for the way they have allowed me to take that sort of lead role and not question it So all the teams really made a significant impact on me, and I'm grateful for all of them. And they all are doing really well, at least most of them. And so I'm really proud of what we have manifested over the years. Most of the sous chefs that I work with are actually head chefs now in some fantastic places. And the ones that have quit because they just don't want to be in the industry, which I understand too.
How did the role with Andrew McConnell come about?
So right after lockdown, I mean, I guess with lockdown, what happened is most partners actually finally got to be intimate. And I got pregnant. And I remember calling my mom up. She was living with us at the time. And I said, this is not happening. It's going to stagnate my career. It's going to slow me down. I'm not doing it. And she sort of pulled the reel back and said, no, that's not fair. You know, I'll always support you. I'll drop everything and come and support you. But you must be a part of history, the right part of history. You know, if you want to make this change, it's important that you think bigger, broader, be more of a visionary. And right after lockdown, when I had Inaya, I thought it was time for a change. I just felt like a change. It was just, I was ready for a change. And Ben Pollard at the time was looking for just a pool of talent, because that's just, yeah, what Ben does. He's amazing at spotting the right person for the right job. And I started conversation with him, and one thing led to another, and he got to know me and understand me and what I wanted. And that's when he offered me, I had interviewed for the head chef position, but he sort of saw where I stand and where it is. And he said, what about a kitchen manager? I think it'll be great to take this for the next couple of years, because it still allows you to be a part of the bigger decision making and flare your personality, but also your experience that you have. And then when you're ready for that next step, we'll direct you into that position. And Chef Andrew and Christopher Handel at the time were very supportive of that. And for me, it was an absolute, it's a chance I couldn't miss. It would be silly of me not to do that. I have always wanted to work for Chef Andrew, like most chefs in the country, I think. Why wouldn't you want to work for him? And I was, yeah, and I took the, I grabbed the opportunity before it went to anyone else. So it was a no-brainer for me. It was a no-brainer. I was like, yes, please.
What's Andrew like to work with? He's such a lovely man to meet in person and such a passionate about what he does. But do you have any stories of the interactions that you have with him?
Yes. So Chef Andrew has been nothing but a gentleman. He's an absolute gentleman. You know, you don't find many gentlemen in the kitchen. but he's an absolute gentleman to talk to. The way he does a tasting, the way he navigates his vision. JP and Ben Pola, who closely work with him, all three of them are just, I mean, you know, every conversation I have with him where I'm having a difficult moment or I'm struggling with something, I always walk out of it richer with knowledge and a different perspective. And it's a progressive perspective. It's moving in the right direction. I wouldn't say it's across the border. Like, you know, we still have people that we need to work with and understand and sort of, you know, I get told a lot of the times, oh, you're so lucky, your kitchen manager. And I find that quite offensive, to be quite honest. because I think it's you know, I deserve to be where I am. And I think they see it that way. They see it as I deserve to be there. So it's always a rich conversation with them. But Andrew is very disciplined. I remember at the AO when I was the lead role for the AO Australian Open pop-up for Supernormal, and I was doing the pass, and he was very gentle about coming to me and to Ben, and he looked at the pass and said, oh, your pass is so messy. How do you think? And I looked at him and said, oh, sorry, chef. And he said, no, that's okay. And he just ripped all the, not ripped them, but he took the dockets and he gave it to Ben and said, do it again. So, you know, in a very eloquent way, he sort of said, no, this is not happening. And you know, to it was absolutely right when he did it, and the way he sort of wanted to see it, and the way Ben Poehler and JP executed it was much better and much smoother. So again, I learned something, and I was like, I can't wait for more of these moments.
It's interesting how you mentioned about women in high-ranking roles in hospitality and kitchens. What was it like for you, the pressures of feeling that obligation with creating a family, having a senior role as well, and managing all of that? Do you think there was different pressures to what a male would experience?
Absolutely, Anthony. I mean, I hate to say it, like, you know, I don't want to offend anyone, and this is not a go at anyone, but this is just the reality of it. Unless you're a chef owner who owns the place or is a partially, you know, involved in the bigger sort of stakeholder joints, you make that decision for yourself. But coming from an employee part of things, I even remember calling up so many of my mates and people that I respected, I looked up to, and said, hey, I'm pregnant, what do you think? And they go, everyone had this tone saying, you know, and there was no, I mean, I think 90 to 95% of the people, and they were highly skilled individuals in fantastic positions, you know, and again, visionaries, but this was just the stigma. I do remember a few of my friends approaching me to open a cafe with them, which was, I'm internally grateful for it. But again, I wasn't given a choice. It was assumed that, oh yeah, you're going to take it, aren't you? Because don't you want this life now? And I was like, no, not really. Thank you. And I appreciate the love, but I wasn't even given an option. And that's why I called my mom up saying, I'm terrified. I've invested 14, 15 years, and all I got is, you know, I get given a bunch of flowers saying good luck for the next move. I'm like, what do you mean? My colleagues who got pregnant who were head chefs got told, well, the next step is executive chef, I guess. You've got responsibilities now. And for me, it was always, you know, do you want to go into a production line, prep kitchen, head of this, head of that? As much as I appreciated those options, I don't think I was ever, it was a bit of a devaluing situation rather than a value you more now because you have more strength because, you know, you've now just given birth. I mean, look at you coming back in your whites and wanting more. You've got more of a bite now, you know. and I think Joshua Bedell, for that matter, I mean, you know, he has always been thinking outside the box. He's from New York, so he's always had a bigger vision to things. And he was probably one of the only chefs who said, what do you mean? You're a leader. You're a born leader. It's what you do. And there's no slowing down. There's probably taking a little bit of a halt while you align with values that align with yours. And then you move forward from there. And that's where I guess Andrew happened. And that's where I took that plunge because I thought, yes, this is exactly the pathway I would like to move forward with. Yeah, so no, definitely a challenging role. I think a lot of women are told that. I think especially from where I came from the early 2000s, you know, like I said, after COVID, the industry is evolving. We still have a lot of work to do, and I think it's a decade away. But there is definitely more, you know, around the language we use, work-life balance, gender equality, all of that. I do think there is a fine line between all of that because, you know, the kitchen is a hard place to be. It does require discipline and diligence and time to learn your craft. I mean, these days, everybody sees 500 videos and works in three places and they're like, oh, I'm ready for a head chef position, which is great. That kind of confidence is great. It's amazing. But it has to be aligned with realistically, it takes practice to perfect things.
What sort of advice do you have for those out there that might be stepping into a big role like yourself that you have at the moment that is sort of controlling all the costs and the operations of such an important restaurant in Melbourne? What sort of advice would you have for those that are moving into a role like that?
To be patient. I think that's the biggest thing I learned with every step of going into a management position is, you know, I had a little firecracker in my bum when I first, with my first role in sous chef, as a sous chef at Ginger Boy, I think. I was 24, I was young, I thought, you know, the sun shined off my ass. So I was like, yeah, yes, this is it. You know, this is me. I'm the next best thing. But come fast forward 10 years and I still feel like I'm learning. I still feel like I've got so much to learn in terms of produce, in terms of numbers, in terms of the ever-changing trend, in terms of, you know, just culture. Work culture is so important to build, and all those things take time. Even a relationship takes four seasons to actually understand a person, to be quite honest. So it's important to give yourself time and actually be patient, be forgiving, and have a big heart. I mean, you know, food and hospitality is about carrying somebody's heart in your heart and doing the right thing. I've always worked for all the people that I've worked for, from Lynch's to Teak to Chris Lucas to Andrew. I've always walked into a venue like it was my own. I have never looked at a job like it was a job. I've always looked at things like, you know, if this was mine, what would I do? And I would give it 100% or maybe 200%. And that's what I've done. And yeah, just remember to stay loyal to the people as well. You know, it's not just about your vision. So I think it's patience is the key here. Patience and being a better listener and not getting offended very often. If your idea is not been absorbed, it's probably not the right time for that idea to come to life.
Well, your influence has affected so many and in such so many important restaurants as well. What do you love about what you do?
I mean, you know, I'm going to use the cliche word is, you know, I think I was born to do this. It's in my blood. I love the blood, sweat and tears. I love food. I love how it connects everyone. I love the idea that, you know, where we come from, whether it be the UAE, whether it be Dubai or Abu Dhabi, where you go to eat a shawarma on the street, or you go to India, whether you eat a pawad on the street, or you go to France, where there's a brasserie. I love how it doesn't matter which background you come for or the stature you come from. Everybody eats the same croissant that's worth €1. Everybody eats the same pawad that's worth $10. And I think I love how food just, you know, equalizes everyone as just human beings. There's nothing more to it. There's no rich or poor or middle class to it. And I think that's the biggest thing that makes me happy, to see people sitting on one table from every walk of life and just purely enjoying that moment of nourishing their soul. And I think that makes me happy to see that kind of equality in this world.
Well, Nabila, it's an absolute honor to have you on Deep in the Weeds today, and look forward to seeing your influence blossom even further.
No, Anthony, the honor is mine. Thank you so much. I don't realize myself if I've influenced many, but if I have, then it's been an absolute pleasure to do so. And I look forward to many more years, two more decades to come.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. Please keep in touch and we'll catch up again soon.
Will do. Thank you, Anthony. Thank you.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we take a deep dive into the lives of the incredible people who ply their trade in the food and hospitality sector. Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen. Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds podcast, or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au. Stay safe and be well.